Good evening. I'm Leland Vittert. We have two big exclusive stories tonight. An American mask manufacturer who answered the call when the pandemic struck now is trying to sell to the U.S. government, but the government is giving Chinese companies the fat contracts. That CEO joins us. Plus, remember this video of illegal immigrants dropped off at the San Antonio airport and heading to the city of their choice? Ali Bradley is back with who is paying for the tickets. But first, another textbook raid by American Special Forces, this time into Syria to kill the new leader of ISIS. This is video from locals in northern Syria. You can hear the firefight between Delta Force operators and ISIS loyalists. They hit a compound belonging to Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qurayshi. He blew himself up rather than fighting. A Syrian civilian group says 13 people, including 6 kids, died during the raid. The Pentagon blames those deaths on the suicide blast of al-Hashimi rather than American fire. On their way out, the American forces blew up a Black Hawk helicopter. You can see it burning right there. The specially built chopper suffered a mechanical issue, so rather than leave the top secret technology behind, they destroyed it before flying out. First off, let's wave the flag for a second. Once again, America takes care of business in a way that no other country on earth can. Brave men loaded up on helicopters in the middle of the night, flew hours into enemy territory, and killed people who wanted to kill us. It is that simple. And for a president with foreign policy disaster after foreign policy disaster, most notably the Afghanistan withdrawal, where in addition to these pictures, 13 American service members died in a suicide attack, and then a series of intelligence failures led to an American drone strike that killed 11 innocent civilians, today is a real win for America. So no surprise that President Biden came out for a victory lap.
Knowing that this terrorist had chosen to surround himself with families, including children, we made a choice to pursue a special forces raid at a much greater risk than to our own people, rather than targeting him with an airstrike. We made this choice to minimize civilian casualties.
Let's think about that choice for a minute. A few laser-guided 2,000-pound bombs would have taken out al-Hashimi's compound just fine. The Pentagon would have released drone video of it. We could have all moved on without putting a single American at risk. We know ISIS leaders routinely use suicide vests and booby traps, as al-Hashimi did. So the United States sent dozens of Americans into harm's way, risking their life and possibly capture. Plus, we lost a helicopter along the way. Why? You heard the president, to prevent civilian casualties. Think about that. The civilians were likely to die anyway. Many of those in the compound were in one way or another part of ISIS, and the civilians that died in this raid were killed by the bad guys. The Pentagon says our forces didn't kill a single civilian. Al-Hashimi took over ISIS from Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who died in a similar raid. Again, hats off to the Delta operators. They were following orders. But why risk their lives? Think about it from the terrorist point of view. If they surround themselves with women and children, the terrorists now know, for certain, rather than getting droned or killed in an airstrike, they will have a chance to fight Americans. They can lure us in and then try to blow Americans up. Or America won't want to take the risk of sending Delta Force operators in, and the terrorists get to keep being terrorists. Don't you think the next leader of ISIS will have even a better compound, more booby traps? No battle plan lasts past initial enemy contact. Bin Laden, al-Baghdadi, and now this guy all died with zero U.S. casualties. Incredible. They were taken out by brave Americans, a long way from home at great personal risk. I've lived in the Middle East for 4 years, covered war for a long time. At some point, our luck will run out. Then what? What if today we had 12 Americans dead from a helicopter crash? Or worse, 6 captured and in the hands of terrorists? How would the commander-in-chief's decision to protect civilian casualties look then? For that, we bring in former ambassador-at-large and coordinator for counterterrorism, Nathan Sales, now with the Counter-Extremism Project. Good to see you, Mr. Ambassador. Thank you. Is protecting civilians really worth the risk to Americans?
Hey, Leland, thanks for having me on. And the answer is yes. And the reason is because that's who we are as Americans. Americans play by the rules. And one of the most important rules of warfare is you can target your enemies, but you can never target civilians. And you have to take precautions to prevent civilians from being harmed inadvertently. And so there's another good reason to keep in mind why you don't want to just drop the building, because we could have dropped the building and moved on. But if we'd done that, not only would we have harmed civilians, we also would have lost the opportunity to collect information that we could use for intelligence purposes. We can get laptop computers, we can get cell phones, we can get documents, and our intelligence analysts can figure out where ISIS is getting its money from, what operations they have planned, who's in charge of what organizations. So there's lots of good reasons why you want to put boots on the ground rather than Clinton-style sending in Tomahawk cruise missiles and hoping for the best.
Okay, fair enough point when it comes to intelligence gathering. Obviously, from the al-Baghdadi raid and also from the bin Laden raid, we got huge intelligence droves. Reasonable people can agree that if we send an airstrike in and drop the building, that would be well within inside the rules of war.
Well, in this case, the building had a number of civilians who, as far as we know at this early stage, had no connection to ISIS whatsoever, right? It's three stories. The second and third story are ISIS people, but the first story appears to have been completely unrelated civilians. And that's one of the most important reasons why you need to be very precise and discerning in the way in which you apply force.
Yeah, I guess I understand that, but at some level, during World War II, you do your best to minimize civilian casualties, but you have to prosecute and fight the war. And I guess I'm still trying to understand, how many Americans do you risk? I think about when I lived in Israel, the Israelis drop buildings all the time, and they say, look, we are not going to be the ones to put our guys at risk of being captured.
Right. The Israelis drop buildings all the time, but what they often do 5 minutes before that is call all the civilians inside and say, you better move fast. So look, our operators are incredibly professional and they know the drill. They know that they are exposing themselves to greater risk because they're going to fight by the rules. And that's part of the reason why they're so heroic. And that's part of the reason why we honor them to the degree that we do, because they fight hard, but they fight fair. And they're willing to expose themselves to a greater risk of operational failure, but also a greater risk of injury or even death, precisely to uphold Central American values like protecting civilians.
Fair enough. We'll move on from that. I'm wondering, so much of this decision comes at sort of after a year of the Biden administration's issues. One of the biggest issues they had was the withdrawal from Afghanistan, and obviously that drone strike that killed 11 civilians was a complete operational failure and a complete intelligence failure during the withdrawal. Admiral Kirby said that had absolutely nothing to do with the decision to send Delta in to Syria. Take a listen.
What factored into that decision, Louis, was our longstanding practice of trying to minimize civilian harm, not what happened on the 29th of August or on any other day.
You've been in the room making those decisions. You never make them in a vacuum.
That's right. Every decision you make, you're mindful of mistakes that were made in the past, and you're mindful of successes that were made in the past. And I think it's very important to understand that the victory that the United States achieved today in Syria is not possible in Afghanistan. The reason we were able to do what we did in Syria was because we still have boots on the ground, a small number of American soldiers there focused on counterterrorism, and also the ability to collect intelligence. Thanks to the Biden administration's withdrawal from Afghanistan, we have none of those things in that country. And so as the ISIS affiliate there grows stronger and as al-Qaeda tries to reconstitute itself in Afghanistan, we are going to be in a far worse position to know what our enemies are up to or to take action against them. So I think one of the lessons we need to learn from today is counterterrorism only really works when you have troops and intelligence assets on the target.
Got it. Hey, Ambassador, I wish we could talk all hour. This is a fascinating discussion. Your experience is deep and allows us to have a deep conversation, but unfortunately, we got to move on. It was good to see you, sir. Thank you. You're absolutely right to salute the best among us for their bravery today. Good to see you.
Thanks, Leland.
Yeah, thank you. Your taxpayer dollars are being used, and we now know this, to fly migrants across the country. That's not us saying it. That's not an investigation. This is a nun who helps relocate people who have entered the country illegally. Take a listen.
I guess you could say got lucky to get reimbursed to some of the efforts that we've been doing for so long, you know, and so that's good. I'm glad we, and that is taxpayers' money.
That is taxpayers' money. Her group helps put these people on trains and buses with a one-way ticket to the city of their choice. Now, the Biden administration is paying this group back, and the price tag isn't cheap. We'll get to the price tag in a minute. This is video of the people lining inside the San Antonio airport. Allie Bradley took this video. As we've reported, not all of these migrants are traveling in family units. That's important because under current law, single adults are to be deported immediately to slow the spread of COVID. Single adult males, though, have been coming in groups to airports and bus stations. We bring in independent journalist Allie Bradley, who uncovered this story from a snowy South Texas. Thank you for being outside, first of all. Allie, tell us how you followed the money back to this group with this nun.
I mean, honestly, Leland, I had talked to Sister Norma Pimentel back in August, and when I started really investigating all of this, and she at that time said, you know, we're getting donations. We might apply for some money. We know that the government has some money available, but we haven't gotten any of that. Well, when I was back down in Texas this time around, I gave her another opportunity to chat with me again and just had the conversation and asked, you know, this has got to be expensive. How can people help? You know, how much are we putting into this? And she was talking about what you just heard, that, you know, they got lucky and it is taxpayer money. And she even went on to say they're getting about $1 million and they might even get more.
And does the federal government know what they're doing with the money?
You know, I honestly don't know that, Leland, because what they're doing is applying within a humanitarian grant that is available for a lot of different charities. We know in Yuma, they also have an NGO there that is getting FEMA reimbursement, which that too comes down to the taxpayer money, right? So we know now that NGOs are, in fact, we've seen them assisting these migrants. We know that the NGO down in the Rio Grande Valley, the Catholic Charities, they are the biggest NGO that is the busiest sector, and they've helped more than 200,000 people. And so you're hearing them say, you know, that is taxpayer dollars. We do buy some of these flights. She admitted that to me for the first time. I've never had anybody tell me that they have paid for some flights for these migrants. It's always been something that has been skirted, that has been swept under the rug. We have never really gotten someone on camera saying we're buying tickets with taxpayer dollars.
Yeah, it actually is stunning to have made the connection, because all of us who've been down on the border and reported have always wondered, where's the money coming from? And now we know you were able to follow the money. This is a little more of your interview with the sister talking about some of the failures on the border. Take a listen.
I think that clarity is definitely something that is missing and that needs to be in place so that we can help these families understand their hopes and expectations, whether they're valid or not.
How much of this is the Catholic Charities doing God's work, because you have tens of thousands of people every month literally just being put out onto the streets in the Rio Grande Valley, and they got to go somewhere at some point because of the administration's policies? And how much of this is the charities encouraging people to come?
You know, I know that this is all organized, Leland. We've talked about this several times. These people don't show up here by chance. So the fact that these NGOs, we have heard that they're on the other side, you know, in Mexico as well. When I was walking in the caravans, there are NGOs that assist on that side as well. Now, Catholic Charities down there is not present in, you know, in Mexico and in the Rio Grande Valley. They have different charities down there that are working together. Now, how much of that, when they're talking about they get donations and they also get taxpayer dollars and FEMA reimbursements and all of these things, how much are they really spending on these migrants, and how much is going back to the charity and the people that work for them? That is the next part of the investigation I need to really dig into.
Yeah, well, and also you think about all the people who got free plane tickets. They call their friends and their family back home and say, hey, look, I came across the border, I got a free plane ticket. Also following up with the administration in terms of what these grants were for and what's being done with them. Allie, incredible reporting. It's why we keep having you back at Allie Bradley TV on Twitter. It's worth a follow if you care about the border story. Thank you.
Thank you, Leland.
Now, we've kind of laid out exactly what's going on the border. There are thousands of people who are just released every day. Should taxpayer money be used to send people who came across the border illegally to the U.S. city of their choice? We want to know what you think. Join the conversation. Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, all at Leland Vittert. Up next, the government is buying and distributing 400 million masks. Why are none of them American-made? Plus, this is CNN. A scandal shakes up the cable giant, pushing its president out the door. There are new questions about who, specifically the guy on the left, what he knew and when did he know it.
The sort of optics and messaging of sending something to Americans' homes that says made in China on it, at the same time that you're, you know, doing this thing that you consider to be a positive good for Americans, and just kind of the overall, you know, philosophy of giving federal contracts to China.
Well, I would say our objective and continues to be to increase U.S. manufacturing capacity of tests. We also needed to meet a need that we had in this country for more tests and a shortage of tests and the understandable demand from people across this country to get tests and make them free and accessible, which required us purchasing some of those tests from China in order to meet that demand.
That's Jen Psaki telling a reporter why Americans are using made in China products for COVID at home tests. And COVID tests aren't the only thing made in China. So's the PPE the government is giving away to help protect you from the virus. The 400 million free N95 masks that the Biden administration is handing out were all made in China, our adversary. The government says it needs to replenish the country's emergency stockpile of N95 masks and plans on signing contracts with domestic manufacturers that can produce 141 million masks per month. That means a huge number of small U.S. mask makers will not be part of the deal. This is a story we've been following for a while. News Nation correspondent Brian Enten met with one of those small mask producers just 2 weeks ago, Luis Arguello, and visited his plant in Florida. Arguello used to make bandages used in surgeries, but he nearly went out of business during the pandemic because of the ban on non-essential medical procedures. So he spent big money retooling his plant to make masks, and now this. Luis with us here. Boy, you double whammy, right? People aren't buying masks because the administration's giving them away for free, and the administration won't buy your masks.
Yes, unfortunately, it's been quite a roller coaster ride over the last couple of years. Very large ups and downs, scaling to become the largest mask manufacturer in the United States to mass layoffs, laying off close to 2,000 employees who were manufacturing U.S.-made masks. We tried to communicate this to the government about a year ago that we needed help in order to stay in business. We didn't get help, and we had to shut down the mask facilities.
When you say shut down, so there were a lot of people who were out of business, out of work, and you guys, I'm sure, spent a lot of money on the mass facilities are losing money. Why do you think the administration's so unhelpful?
Unfortunately, I think the mask situation has been quite politicized since the beginning of the pandemic. There has not been, up until a few weeks ago, a clear demand signal from the CDC telling people the quality of masks that you wear manufacturers. Initially, they said, don't wear a mask, wear a scarf, wear a bandana. And recently, within the last month, they came out and said, wear a good mask. We, as the American manufacturing facilities, we've had excess capacity for close to 2 years where we could have been producing hundreds of millions, if not billions of masks and creating a large stockpile. They're giving out 400 million masks, but that is only three per American for a mask that's been intended to be used one per day. So they're giving you 3 days worth of product. What happens after that? And the reality is that the majority of the mask manufacturers today are not scaling because we have not been contacted to start producing and to start manufacturing again.
Is there, other than cost, right, because an N95 mask in China is 25 cents, 75 cents for one manufactured in the U.S., but 60% of the Chinese masks failed U.S. inspection requirements, so do the math. But why on earth would an administration that says that they are so committed to U.S. manufacturing of something that is so critical not call you guys?
It makes absolutely no sense. Even today, I lost a bid yesterday to the city that I live in Miami-Dade County, where they went and bought a Chinese mask because it was about 20 cents cheaper. It's very unfortunate. It's cheaper for two reasons. The materials they use, they don't work. They're non-regulated. A lot of them have graphene or formaldehyde, which are carcinogenic and can cause severe damage to your body. And they pay no labor or slave labor rates, where in the United States we're paying a living wage. So it's quite unfortunate that we have not had the support from the state or the city governments.
Or the federal government. They say they need people who can make 141 million masks a month. That's a lot of masks. I'm guessing only the biggest of big companies can do that. Does the fact that you can't do that seem to justify not buying from you?
Well, it is a lot of masks, but we have 300 plus million Americans, so that's half a mask a month. Is that enough? I think we need a lot more than that. We need billions a month in order for us to be able to have a steady supply of masks for the near future. Now, the reality is no one wants to wear a mask. I agree. I myself don't like wearing one. But we need to have the domestic capacity if and when we need one in the future. Military.
That's we don't
want to use it, but right. We have it.
Well, no, and if there's another pandemic and China decides to play hardball, you have to have the capacity and you have to have the stockpile. Why you'd buy it from China versus the United States is bewildering to me. I sort of wrote this down. You kind of answered it a little bit. We sort of take a dim view of masks on the show as well, just because unless you're wearing an N95 mask, it doesn't really do that much. But when the pandemic ends, if you're not selling masks anymore and the federal government won't buy them from you, what's your guy's plan after spending all this money on the plant?
Well, hopefully we won't have to shutter the facilities. Luckily, our company manufactures a lot of medical devices and have been doing so for decades. The funny part or the interesting part is that usually in medical devices, no one will accept a Chinese device. No one will accept a Chinese pacemaker, because if it fails, your patient dies. Yet on masks and tests, all of a sudden, the two things that matter, everyone is willing to buy a Chinese product because it's cheaper. No one's going to inject a Chinese vaccine. Why should we do the same with a mask?
That's a great question. One I suspect people might start asking the administration. Hey, Louis, we really appreciate you joining us. You're doing great work. I know it must be difficult, but there's a lot of us who appreciate that if we need you, you're going to be there. And we'll check back in with you, all right?
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Yeah, no, thank you. Fascinating. We're going to introduce you to the mayor who doesn't breathe for pictures. It's a remarkable skill when we come back. Welcome back. It appears the mayor of Los Angeles and nominee for U.S. Ambassador to India, Eric Garcetti, possesses truly remarkable superhuman powers. We couldn't make this up. Despite a strict mask mandate in Los Angeles, here's Garcetti maskless at Sunday's Rams 49ers playoff game. He appears to be doing quite well and in perfect health in this picture. He's in the suite with Magic Johnson, maskless. According to Garcetti's own rules, the only reason to have your mask off is active eating or drinking. So, what gives?
When people ask for a photograph, I hold my breath and I put it here and people could see that. There's a 0% chance of infection from that.
My parents are watching this show and sometimes they say people speak quickly, so let's just for them play that one more time.
When people ask for a photograph, I hold my breath and I put it here and people could see that. There's a 0% chance of infection from that.
Never mind that if you think masks are so important, you would always wear a mask in pictures to set the example. But put that aside for a minute. How would that excuse go over with kids at the LA schools or any school, for example? Can kids hold their breath too? Maybe this young man whose teacher duct taped a mask to his face was holding his breath. We'll never know. What about the next time you're on an airplane? Next time someone gets thrown off an airplane for not wearing a mask? Maybe they should claim they're holding their breath. It goes back to what we said last night. It is almost impossible, sadly, for people, especially people in power, to admit they were wrong. And now we move on.
The pioneering figure, and now his resignation is stunning this newsroom and the news industry.
Well, on to other people who love to tell you how to live your life from a glass house. That's CNN media reporter and pundit Brian Stelter, eulogizing the career of now former CNN president and Stelter's big supporter, Jeff Zucker. Aside from looking rather similar to each other, Stelter is seen in the media community as Zucker's mouthpiece on the network. As you no doubt heard, Zucker resigned yesterday on news that he had a long-running affair with his number two that he didn't disclose. Back to Stelter for a second and his favorite CNN anchor, Allison Camerota, who loved to opine from the moral high ground on other network sex scandals. Here they are, 4 years after the Roger Ailes scandal, talking about Fox News.
And you asked me then, God, is Fox just rotten to the core? And I said something like, no, right. It's not rotten to the core. There are good people there. Given everything that has come out since then, I guess it is rotten to the core.
The word cult came up over and over and over again. There's a reason why people describe this as a cult.
It's clear Stelter and Camerota have zero tolerance for bad behavior. Good on them. What's really curious is the headlines over the past 24 hours that indicate Zucker's affair was hardly a well-kept secret. New York Post calls it an open secret at CNN and in the media world, period. So we're in a bit of a quandary. Why did Stelter, who found sex affairs at other networks so newsworthy, never write a piece about such an obvious news story literally a few offices away? For answers to such difficult moral quandaries, we bring in Chadwick Moore. Floor is yours, my friend. I don't have an answer.
Well, we really have to ask ourselves, Leland, is CNN just rotten to the core? Is CNN just rotten to the core? It certainly is the...
We may never know the answer. Chadwick had an answer, perhaps, to that. We're going to see if we can get him back. Chadwick, if you hold your head really still, we may not lose your signal again. Are they rotten to the core?
I think that they might be rotten to the core. Yes, indeed. And they are certainly the network of sex pests at the moment.
Let me play the other side of this, right? Isn't that part of the problem, though, to not simply say either, hey, let everyone do their own thing and stop dunking when somebody else has a problem, or risk the flip side?
Well, here's the big issue this happens all the time in social media world. You have coworkers having affairs, executives having affairs, and these people cheating on their spouses. This isn't what this is about. This is about Chris Cuomo seeking revenge. All right. So Zucker is he's falling on the knife for the network because Chris Cuomo wants $18 million in severance for when he was fired from CNN. The real story here is how much Chris Cuomo, Zucker, this woman that Zucker was having an affair with, all worked with Andrew Cuomo to make him look good during COVID, all right? The most trusted name in news, here we have it, working hand in hand, coaching one of the most powerful Democrats in the country, how to handle his press briefings, how to address Trump's criticisms. That's what this is really about. The sex scandal is to cover it up. All right, it's to say this is why he's leaving. It's not why he's leaving.
I didn't consider that they have more, perhaps. I guess, is this supposition that they have more on Andrew Cuomo and Zucker, or you have some reporting or knowledge on that?
Yeah, according to insiders that spoke to the New York Post just recently, is that there is a lot of stuff against Zucker in a lawsuit that Chris Cuomo has drafted against CNN. And basically, they're saying, get rid of Zucker, fall on the sword, and give Cuomo some money, and we'll make this go away. So a lot of it, people are saying, wow, according to the New York Post, is that Zucker also wants to protect his reputation for what else might be in that lawsuit, what else that lawsuit is accusing him of.
I just always go back, though, to the holier-than-thou and the sanctimony over a sex scandal at one network over the other. It's Morning Joe. It's not Morning Joe and Mika, yet they're married, and yet they have no problem calling out everyone else for sex scandals. And then you think about Fox News, my old employer, Jesse Waters, on the CNN scandals. Take a listen.
Likely this is Chris Cuomo getting revenge on Jeff for canceling him in disgrace and not paying out the rest of his salary. This is on the heels of the Jeffrey Toobin situation, you know, the CNN lawyer who got caught red-handed mixing business with pleasure on a Zoom call. And then there was not one but two producers at the network who left after being tied to alleged sex crimes with kids. All this while Don Lemon's fighting a lawsuit where he's accused of shoving his hands down a man's pants.
All coming from a man who was married, dated his producer, and then married his producer. If there's anything we abhor the most, it's hypocrisy on this. Why the need to dunk from the glass house? And why is that seemingly okay?
Well, we see this in cable news all the time. Yeah. It's this fight between back and forth. I shouldn't think we should be surprised by that at all. Like I said before, I think the biggest scandal is that CNN pretends to be this neutral balanced source of information when in fact they are Democrat Party propagandists. They work hand in hand with powerful Democrats. That should be the scandal. That should be how they protected Andrew Cuomo, you know, while he was sending sick people into nursing homes during the COVID crisis, while he's killing untold numbers of people. Of course, this is also how they got rid of Andrew Cuomo, right? It was a sex scandal. It wasn't any other thing that you could have possibly done, you know, writing a book about how great he was during COVID, profiting off of the death of New Yorkers, things of that nature. So sex is always sexy. People want to read about it. People want to shame people for it. But really, there's probably uglier things going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, and sometimes it's easier to come back from a sex scandal. You go to rehab, you write a book, you do some charity work, and then you're suddenly employable again. If you actually get fired for some of the reasons you talked about, it's a little harder to come back. Chadwick, your signal froze again, so we're glad we got through the conversation. We'll see you soon, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Coming up, Democrats try to shed the defund the police label. Is it too late before the midterms?
The answer is not to defund the police. It's to give you the tools, the training, the funding to be partners, to be protectors, and community needs you and know the community.
That happened on this day in history. Today, President Biden doing what would have been unthinkable during his campaign in 2020, appearing with pro-police funding ex-cop New York City Mayor Eric Adams during a visit to address the city's soaring crime problem. The president and fellow Democrats are pinning the surge on the proliferation of guns. It's guns is the problem, they say. But today's visit comes amid plunging poll numbers over his administration's response to crime. Recent poll found 57% of Americans disapprove of Mr. Biden's handling of crime, just 37% approve. And a new Gallup Mood of the Nation poll shows a 23% drop. 23% over the past 2 years in Americans' confidence in the nation's policies to reduce or control crime. The president's visit comes a day after New York City police officer William Mora was laid to rest, one of two officers gunned down in an ambush attack 2 weeks ago. Seven officers have been killed nationwide already this year. Aaron Durkin, reporter for Politico New York, with us, laid things out. I'm wondering if you think about the sort of center, in a way, of the defund the police movement really took hold of progressive policies in New York, thinking about Bill de Blasio. Are centrist Democrats getting worried about that now?
Yeah, I mean, I think they are to some extent. I mean, you know, Eric Adams, the new mayor, ran on a very clear message that he was going to take care of crime, that he is a former NYPD officer himself. And he does, he strikes a balance. He's been a reformer for a long time. He, within the police department, was critical of the police department and of some of the abuses that took place. You know, but his clear message was, you know, the violence has gotten out of control and we need to use the police as one of many tools, but emphatically use the police to get that under control. And, you know, he was able to win on that message in a very crowded primary field. So that seems to be the prevailing sentiment at this point. Not universal, but, you know, enough to at least get him elected.
Right. And to get a presidential visit as well. And noteworthy that we didn't hear a lot from the president talking about the DA, who's gotten a lot of criticism for his policies on bail and on light sentences from the president. This was focused on Mayor Adams, although Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez not very happy. We risk reverting back to a 90s era, quote unquote, tough on crime rhetoric where policies may be rolled out to make it look like we're being responsive to public safety, but could actually be making those issues worse, even if they might play well politically, .. If she runs for Senate, she's still staking out the progressive side of soft on sentencing and low or no bail.
Yeah, well, I believe she has said at least that she's going to rule that out at this point for this year. But yeah, that is a sentiment we're hearing from a lot of progressives in the city. She is not alone. You know, a lot of city council members, a lot of civil rights groups are also expressing concerns that, you know, he is swinging the pendulum
Let me just ask you this real quick. You say the civil rights groups are expressing concerns. Are there any centrist Democrats, especially in swing districts outside of New York City, who are concerned about the concern and just wish the progressives would be quiet ahead of the midterms?
I'm sure there are plenty of people who wish that they would be quiet, yes.
Okay.
But, you know, here in New York City, those folks are speaking up. And are kind of critical of the mayor and, you know, of the president for sort of embracing the mayor.
Hey, Aaron, always great reporting. Playbook New York and your reporting picked up on Playbook around the country here today. Good to see you. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah, not just in New York City. Other big cities like Chicago also have huge waves of crime. Republicans especially are looking to capitalize on the issue.
Pritzker's leftist agenda is literally killing us, turning parts of Illinois into a war zone, and take the cuffs off our cops and put them back on criminals.
I played a lot during the football games this weekend. The man you see, Jesse Sullivan, Republican candidate for governor of Illinois, on set with us. I understand what the mayor can do about crime. I understand what a DA can do about crime. There's not a lot that a governor can do, is there?
Oh, there is plenty a governor can do about crime. Number one, this anti-police bill that J.B. Pritzker passed, he owns it. I've been around the state talking with law enforcement officials. We put together a plan, and they said we weren't at the table on this last anti-police bill. So 40 out of the 102 counties, the sheriffs are quitting or retiring early. And
so
it's because—
give me specifics. What would it do?
So, number one, the craziness of this bill is it allows, say, someone's trespassing. You can't even go in as a police officer and evict them and put them in prison for trespassing. You just give them a ticket and you have to leave. Person stays in the place they were trespassing. You've got bail reforms, so people being let out who are violent criminals, who are going to go back out on the streets and commit these crimes again. Two-day holidays for electronic monitoring. Two-day holidays. Just to go out, hey, take a break from your electronic monitoring for a bit. It's
this craziness.
How much
of this, though, is a state law versus, say, in the city of Chicago, where the crimes really spiked, the prosecutor?
Yeah. Kim Fox, I want to challenge J.B. Pritzker to say, enough, Kim Fox, I am not going to support you. He's been holding benefits for her, fundraising, along with George Soros giving her money. He needs to stand up, and I challenge him to say, enough is enough, actually prosecute criminals. Because on the back end of this, you've got all the negative effects. No one will speak up in the communities because they can't trust that actually they're going to be put away and locked away like they should be.
You think about, though, Illinois is a blue state. Is crime enough of an issue for a Republican to win? You're not going to win the city of Chicago.
You know, crime is important to me not because it's a political issue, but because these are my neighbors that are dying. You have Melissa Ortega, who's in Little Village, an 8-year-old little girl, looks just like my 8-year-old little daughter, and she's shot and killed. These are real people's lives, and they deserve to be protected. Just because they're from minority communities does not mean that these lives matter any less. You have to step up and take on this crime problem. And I don't care if it's the top political issue. It's the top issue for people to feel safe out in the state.
Right. If you don't feel safe, it doesn't matter. It's a little bit like crime is becoming the catch-all in the same way education became the catch-all in Virginia as a proxy for other issues. But really, how are you going to swing 15 or 20 points in the city of Chicago on this one issue?
To me, the foundation of our society is safety. And the government needs to provide it for its citizens. They need a leader, not someone who's thinking about poll numbers, someone who's actually, because that's what's happened. The arsonists, like you were saying, have become the firefighters. They're the ones who are talking about defunding the police, devaluing, demeaning them. Now they want to step back some of their rhetoric because they realize this anti-police agenda, it's costing them at the polls. I don't care about the polls. I care about my neighbors' lives in the state of Illinois.
You got to care about the polls, though, if you're going to win. And we've seen President Biden, moderate Democrats starting to tack back. You've seen the mayor of Chicago tack back. See if the governor does as well. Doesn't that just take the wind out of your sails?
No, I would love to see J.B. Pritzker actually prioritize police again, to make them feel prioritized and valued, to make policing a noble profession again. I would love to see that. I don't think it's going to happen because it's a lot of rhetoric.
You think he's a true believer in all this stuff?
Oh,
or you think it's just politically expedient for him?
Yeah, I don't know his heart. All that I know are results. All I know are the people that are being shot on the streets, our law enforcement officers. They don't feel supported right now. Yeah. I care about results, and J.B. Pritzker is not getting them for our law enforcement or for these victims every single day.
All right, Jesse, we appreciate you being here, and obviously this issue's not going away, nor is the governor's race in Illinois. We'll have you back.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Good to see you. Thank you.